Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data Use Scenarios Work Group Meeting Number 10. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Priscilla Dula.
Thank you, Hilda. So good afternoon, everyone. This actually brings us up to our 10th meeting of our multi-stakeholder group, and so we have two more to go. And we really appreciate sort of everyone, you know, joining these calls every 2 weeks and giving us all of these sort of awesome input. So this is Priscilla. Joining me on the call, we have from NORC, Lauren Hovey, Duncan Jindal, and Catherine Donaldson. We also have our colleagues from GW, Jane Thorpe, Tara Cartwright-Smith, Elizabeth Gray. We have Joanna Singerano on the call as well, and she'll be walking us through some of the use case analysis that we've been doing a little later in the meeting. And then from ONC, we have Helen Clayton-Peters and Devi Mehta. And I also see a number of our multi-stakeholder meeting participants that have been joining us very regularly. So I won't go through sort of everyone by name, but please note that we will definitely, you know, mark your participation and you will be included as part of the summary minutes that we prepared. Okay, so I see that the slides have disappeared. Lauren, can you make sure that they projected again? I just wanted to sort of bring up the agenda slide. So I'm going to just sort of keep the discussion moving. So today, we are going to be shifting the focus of our meeting. So we are not going to be talking about some new research data use scenarios. I know we've been spending a number of meetings sort of focused around that. But what we'd like to do today is, you know, catch everyone up on some additional work that the team has been doing related to the research data use scenarios. So what we've done internally, you know, after we've presented the scenarios and gathered your feedback, we've actually been looking across the scenarios, analyzing them, and sort of, if you will, distilling these key requirements across scenarios, and we've sort of aggregated these into what we call use cases, okay? So what we'll be doing today is discussing two of the use cases related to consent management and the use of sensitive data, and we have some additional use cases that we will present on subsequent calls. So that will be sort of the big focus of the discussion today, and then we've also we'll also be providing an update on the patient choice project, and the team that's leading that, Jeremy Maxwell from ONC and the ESEC team have very graciously agreed to provide an overview of the project. And so I know we've, you know, the patient choice project has come up on different calls here. So, you know, we'll have an opportunity, or you'll have an opportunity to hear from them directly on, you know, on what they've been doing and how that project sort of intersects with the work of this project. Okay? All right, so I'm going to move us along. So I'm just going to pause for a second. I don't see any slides up. Is it just me, or are there other people seeing slides?
Oh, we can see the slides, Priscilla.
Oh, okay, good. So then it's just me and my computer with all the gremlins that it's having today. That's quite reassuring. Okay, then let me, I'm actually going to move on to slide 5, which is an overview of sort of the progress so far. Okay. So, Joanna, I'm glad you're on. okay, so just to sort of get everyone on the call oriented, okay. So far, we have worked with you to develop 16 scenarios. And, you know, I think you're all familiar with Max Researcher and all of sort of the different types of data and the different sort of activities that he's been sort of, or he or she has been engaged in, okay? We are working on some additional scenarios focused on patient-generated health data. So it's entirely likely that, you know, after all of this is said and done, you know, we might have like anywhere between, you know, 18 and 20 scenarios, okay? What we've done with these scenarios is, you know, after we've developed all of them, we noticed that there are some, you know, sort of logical thematic areas that they seem to be falling into. So we've begun clustering them into thematic areas. And what I want to stress is that this is very much a work in progress, okay? So today we'll share with you where we stand with this clustering of our scenarios into thematic areas. And then what we've further done is, even across thematic areas, when we've been analyzing the scenarios with Ioana's help, we've been noticing that there's, you know, these common requirements that seem to be emanating from these different thematic areas, and we've distilled those into specific use cases, okay, which we will discuss with you in some detail. So where we stand right now is, you know, we have sort of these 16 scenarios grouped into 9 thematic areas, and they fall under sort of, if you will, 5 use case areas. I think just another point I want to make about these thematic areas. You know, we recognize that there is sort of some overlap in the areas, so they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You know, and it may be that there will be some overlap as we move forward, but, you know, we are working hard to sort of distill, if you will, the key distinguishing components of each of these areas. Okay? That's sort of just an overview of sort of where we stand with, you know, our analysis so far. So next slide, which is slide 6, this should be just sort of an overview of how we've actually sort of organized each of the use cases with the thematic areas and the research data use scenarios. So I know there's sort of a lot on the slide, and I won't go into sort of each of these in a lot of detail, but just to sort of provide, you know, a high-level overview, okay? So, you know, the sort of the use case, one area focuses on combining data for PCOR, and really here, you know, we discuss with you all combining different de-identified data sets, and really what the objective here is to describe how researchers combine de-identified data sets, produce and manage for other purposes, and how we can then leverage them for PCOR. Okay, and, you know, we sought to highlight here some of the policy and technical constraints of, you know, independently managed data sets. Okay. Then use case 2 and use case 3 are what we're going to do sort of a deep dive into today. Use case 2, very briefly, was really to explore sort of the different dimensions of informed consent related to research subject vulnerability and protection status. So, for example, we looked at consent related to minors, prisoners, and decisionally impaired, and sort of the special considerations for each of these, you know, different subject types. Okay. For use case 3, we looked at sort of considerations around both consent and authorization, related to specific facility types, as well as with a particular focus on different, you know, different types of data. Use case 4 around sort of, you know, re-identification and the mosaic effect. We've been looking at sort of the implications of, the implications and the risks of re-identification, particularly around, you know, longitudinal research, the linking of combining multiple data sets, you know, information on family history, which may pose specific risks to privacy, and then also, you know, issues related to combining different types of data sets and, you know, the issues that they pose to privacy as well. And then finally, around use case 5, the focus has been around really looking at sort of this whole new world of different types of patient-generated health data and the use of that data for PCOR, as well as, you know, the specific sort of privacy risks and obligations for data stewardship, recognizing that all of the entities that might hold PGHD are not necessarily, you know, regulated under HIPAA or, other laws. So that's sort of a very quick overview, if you will, of sort of the five use cases. We are going to sort of do a deep dive into two of the use case areas. So, Ioana, let me hand it over to you and get you to sort of orient folks around the use case analysis, and then, you know, we can certainly see if there's any questions that sort of come up from, you know, the overview that you provide.
Sure.
Okay. Next slide.
So basically, use case analysis is about communication, and modeling is about communication. And what we're trying to do is to communicate and identify the key requirements embodied by the research that I use scenarios that you have helped develop. And in some cases, we are clearly identifying a certain objective. So you'll notice the use cases are named basically on the objective that the activities within that use case are trying to accomplish. Combine data use scenario, manage consent. And within each use case analysis, we have a set of preconditions, which in turn may be use cases we decided to delve into in more detail. So, for example, manage consent is a prerequisite for dealing with sensitive or protected data. Therefore, it's a precondition in that use case, but it's also a use case on its own because it's so important to a lot of different activities. Users and systems, also known as actors to the initiate, but are really just those entities, humans or systems that are involved in the activities described by each use case. And again, the use case is a statement of requirements illustrated by scenarios and clearly delineating work steps and work items that have to be undertaken even by a human or by a user, a human being, or by a system. So it's very important that we identify what these entities, users, and systems are in relation to each use case. The data use workflow is also an important way in which we can organize our thinking. Hello? Hello?
I don't think there was a question. Go ahead. Is there somebody that has a question on the call?
I think someone might have a problem with their microphone.
Yeah, no problem, Ioana. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. And finally, the workflow, I think, is a very important piece of information because it's a synthesis of all the steps described in the use case. They are a consolidation of the activities you've seen described in the data use scenarios. And it's supposed to help us arrive at a common understanding of the requirements. So, again, use case analysis, modeling, it's all about communication. It's all about reaching a common understanding of what the requirements that, you know, initially live in the minds and in the thoughts of experts, how they would be conveyed to another set of individuals, other community implementers, policymakers, jurists, and so on. So that is the exercise we undertake here, to communicate and to clarify and to highlight those elements of those requirements that are most relevant to perhaps CLIN 2 and other aspects of privacy and ethical behavior around patient-centered research. So keep in mind that in this derivation, we started with the scenarios because each of our scenarios is an instantiation, is an illustration of the use case. But it may have different nuances to it. It may highlight a specific subset of requirements. And then the use case is more generic in a sense, but is more all-encompassing of all the requirements supported by the data use scenarios. Can we go to the next slide? All right. So going back to the thematic areas and the scenarios that Priscilla introduced, consent management actually has two broader areas of concern, research and age-related consent. And these are the scenarios in which there are some changes in consent management that are introduced by changes in the life of a research participant. So when someone becomes an adult, they may need to reconsent to be part of a research study. And there are also situations when the consent is affected by either a local policy or by the status of the participants, their membership in a special population. So we have two scenarios there related to incarcerated research participants with a stigmatizing condition, and obtaining consent from decisionally impaired individuals who may be permanently or just temporarily decisionally impaired. Next slide. Can we go to, thank you. So this is the most perhaps important part of understanding our documentation, because whenever we're trying to make use of a graphical representation, it's very important to understand what the formalisms are and what the conventions of that representation are. So it's important, therefore, to distinguish the actors, the entities involved in the use case, from each use case. And in this case, we have a primary use case, obtain consent for PCOR, that is basically assuming some other activities have occurred and are in the past and have been addressed. So in our case, we are assuming that the protocol has already defined a process by which the consent is to be obtained from participants. And the Chief Compliance Officer and the IRB have put that in a very clear way and made it available to the researchers. The researchers the data sites and patients or their proxies, you know, their representatives, are involved in overall management of the consent. So in this case, we also introduced for the next generation systems, the need for a consent management that is capable of maintaining the information in electronic form. So we're assuming that is an element of this use case, and that consent is tracked electronically and it's available to the entities that need it. Within the consent management workflow, we have several smaller use cases. So there are use cases that are included in the main use case, and use cases are preconditions to this current use case. And we quickly identify them as, you know, in yellow, just so they stand out a little bit. Those are the preconditions, and you'll see that they are connected to the main use case with a dotted line that says it precedes this use case. So approval of the protocol has to precede the management of the consent. Similarly, we have obtaining protocol, pre-consent for longitudinal study, record authorization to disclose, and revoke consent. These are all part of managing consent, and they are included. Therefore, the dotted line says that these use cases are included in the main use case. So this is just a quick graphical representation that on one piece of paper, it puts together all these different elements involved in our use case. So let's go to the next slide.
Joanna, can I just ask
sure.
if there's any questions from anyone before we move ahead? I know we sort of putting forward a lot of information.
Sure, sure.
So make sure that everyone...
Yeah, so let's go to the previous slide and see if we have any questions there.
Sure. Are there any questions or comments from folks on the phone? I don't see any hands up, but everyone's unmuted, so feel free to ask any questions that you might have.
All right. So, yeah, this diagram is meant to give you a quick mental description, you know, a quick description of what's going on. And then it's elaborated with additional narrative, additional diagrams, goes into the details of how consent is managed. But this is just the initial high-level description of the use case. And it's tricky because whenever you introduce a new notation, people will have their own way of trying to decode it. So we're trying to make sure that there's only one way that everyone on the phone can interpret this particular diagram and its notation elements. Because we're introducing more notation elements. So the workflow. And again, we have two kinds of workflows in this use case analysis. Consent management is perhaps one of the more important and more there are a lot of different conditions and decisions that have to be made in order to manage consent correctly. So in this case, the various use cases that have identified already a set of special populations whose consent is important and who have to be adequately protected in the course of research So we decided to describe the various aspects introduced by multiple data use scenarios into a single decision diagram that takes into account there are several decisions along the way that a researcher might need to make. So in this case, when considering the consent that has to be given by a research participant, one of the first decisions is whether the research participant is incarcerated. And that is a mutual yes or no decision that basically would determine whether additional protections or additional conditions have to be included in the consent to make sure it's complete and it's an informed consent. The second decision is similarly it's an exclusive decision that says, is this patient a member of a special population? And then we have something that is a multiple decision point where any participant could concurrently be a member of more than one special population. So they could be pregnant, minor, and also a member of a native population. So we did not want to make it appear that you can only belong to one special population. You could concurrently belong to more than one special population, and therefore the consent has to take that into account. In some cases, for minors and for decisionally impaired, this process also calls for identifying a representative, a proxy, someone who would be authorized to sign the consent. So this is just a way of us drilling down into the requirements and identifying these very important decision points, which are the diamond-shaped, that are telling us precisely what are the key decisions in this process. Any questions? Any concerns? Did we get any of this wrong? All right, so we can go to the next slide then. So this is an authorization to disclose decision, which now is based on the type of information and the policies that are applicable at any one data site. In this case, we're looking at situations when an authorization is required, and the first decision point is to determine which participants in the study have information that may be deemed sensitive or protected in that organization. And to make sure that an organization policy, a state, whether a state policy or a federal policy is applicable, that all the conditions introduced by that policy are also met by the authorization to disclose. So that may mean things like additional requirements on the receiver of the data, as some policies include, and all of those have to be acknowledged and documented in the authorization signed by the patient. And again, the assumption we make here is the actual authorization is recorded as an electronic document rather than, or I should say artifact. without any bias of implementation, that this would be electronically encoded and electronically available. Any questions?
Hi, this is Marisa in OCR. I'm wondering how HIPAA authorization applicability, the need for it, fits in here, given that, you know, it doesn't matter whether the information is sensitive, for the most part, for our purposes. Does this chart assume that the HIPAA determination of whether authorization is needed is been made already? Is separate?
I believe yes, and if it's useful, we should probably identify it on this chart, Marisa.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be useful. Yeah. We assume that authorization to disclose is required already, so that determination has already been made.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be helpful to mm-hmm. have maybe as a note, even not even on
sure.
the chart.
Sure. No, I would suggest that we could actually make it an explicit decision if you think that would be clarifying.
I think it could be, given that there is the question, of course, of whether an mm-hmm. entity involved is a covered entity or business associate.
Okay. And clearly, since you asked the question, it seems like
right.
It would be useful. Sure. Any other questions or suggestions?
You know, I guess I want to ask of our multi-stakeholder group. I mean, this is sort of, our take as we sort of analyzed, all of the scenarios on the items that, sort of emanated from all of the specific, examples that we had shared with you, right? You know, if there are things that are missing, if there are things that we need to clarify, like Marisa, thank you very much for pointing out sort of the HIPAA authorization piece, then we need to, if you let us know, we're happy to sort of refine them and revise them. So, we are looking for all kinds of feedback because I feel like that's helpful and will make us sort of, enhance what we have and also make them more understandable to our broader audience. Okay, so very interested in the feedback you might have.
So don't hesitate to give it.
Exactly. Better way to put it.
It's the corollary. Thank you, Prashala.
Sure. Go ahead, Yana.
All right. So any other suggestions or recommendations? Again, as Prashala emphasized, this is a communication tool. We want to make sure it's clear. It speaks to you as experts, but it can also be informative to folks who are downstream looking at implementing solutions that that are useful and viable in the marketplace. All right, so next slide then. So we have this is basically our typical workflow, and there are two elements to keep in mind is we are identifying the responsible actor, user, or system in these horizontal lanes. So the researcher in this case and their information system are interacting to accomplish a certain goal. That's really what this diagram tells you in the very beginning. Who's doing what? And we try to keep, again, the icons will tell you that some steps are manual. Also, the coloring is trying to identify steps that are manual from steps that are enabled by systems. In this case, we're showing you how the researcher is identifying the participants in a study who may require or do require a consent. And it's based on the availability of contact information, the availability of information about how these participants may wish to be contacted so they can give their consent or not. And this is just basically a starting point of a process that may unfold differently depending on site. But we're trying to, again, identify those elements of the workflow that we can have consensus around. And if there is no consensus, then to try to identify the various options. Again, we have the ability to say some things are mutually exclusive and some things could allow for multiple options as we have here. So the contact method could be more than one, perhaps via phone or via mail, email or over the phone. So there are multiple options that could apply in this case, and we're trying to identify all of those to communicate that type of requirement, and to also show the interaction between the researcher and their system as they go about acquiring the consent. Any questions? Let's go then to the next slide. So this is giving us another option, another way in which the consent process may start. In this case, the participants in this study identify themselves, volunteer themselves to be part of the study, and they identify the study online. They enter information that may be automatically recorded by a consent management system. Then the follow-up is to reach out to the sites that have information and retrieve that information for research. So this is another way in which individuals may volunteer themselves as research participants and use a set of, in this case, a manual step and an electronic system, an online system, to enter their consent and then from that point start the data use case with a consent recorded electronically. Next slide. So we are now moving into an illustration of how the consent might be applied to a specific data use scenario. So in this case is when consent and/or authorization are required, then we have perhaps the specific type of information, as in behavioral health data, mental health, for example. And in our scenario illustrated how mental health data and physical health data were combined. In other cases, the information that may be subject to consent and authorization may be genomic information that affects not only the research participant, but in our scenario, we had a situation where family members may be affected by it. And also, there are some issues related to disclosing genomic testing to information to minors, or using biomarkers for patient-centered outcome research. And the third thematic areas had to do with individuals who belong to small populations, in this case, Native Alaskan populations, who have additional privacy concerns related to the fact that their information is more widely known to their community, and it's more difficult to keep participation in a research study private. So let's go to the next slide and delve a little bit into the types of participants. So some of you were probably attending an earlier meeting we had about data use scenarios, and we showed a situation when a coordinating center was involved as an honest broker in the entire exchange. This is a little bit different. So in this case, the assumption is that the research organization and the data side would communicate directly with each other in order to support the sharing of sensitive information. And we're also assuming that the consent has already been obtained, and in some cases, if necessary, there is also an authorization to disclose given to the research organization to allow them to share some data sets with the research organization. So I just wanted to, again, highlight that the consent management is assumed to be involved in here, but it's not the primary system in this use case. We are assuming that all of that consent has already been addressed, and we're looking at the issues and activities related to sharing data, including behavioral health or substance abuse or other kinds of behavioral information with researchers, and also addressing the concerns of some special groups by allowing them to have a finely tuned consent and authorization to participate in the research. So next slide. So the process, again, I hate to harken back to something we did several weeks ago, but in this particular workflow, the key elements to keep in mind is that the consent is part of a lot of the decision-making going on at the data site. So we are going to assume in this case that the data site is aware of data use agreements and authorizations to disclose or consents that have been given by the participants. And when they make information available in a peer-to-peer fashion to the research organization, they analyze all that information. And if necessary, they add additional metadata to this information to allow the research organization to handle it according to the policy. So we're making some assumptions here that that consent is not just a piece of paper that goes into a drawer, but it's an electronic artifact that is also applicable downstream when this information is meant to be shared with a research organization. And in this use case, we are expecting the exchange to be on demand. So rather than a periodic transmission of data, the research organization requests the data from the data site, And we're trying to highlight how heavily we rely on interoperability by showing those steps in that very menacing gray color. but it's not because it's menacing to us to have interoperability, but because it is an assumption underlying all of our data use scenarios, that this information is flowing electronically and in a standard-based way between systems and organizations. So that is the underlying assumption we're making. And along the way, the request for data has to be validated, has to be processed, has to be related back to the data sets that the data site is managing. And based on those rules and agreements, and information is made available to the research organization with those added caveats or metadata as necessary. And their assumption is that the receiving system will process the metadata and will make it known to the end user, such that they can use the data in a way consistent with the privacy policies that cover this information.
This is Marisa in OCR. I have a quick question about the legend. What do you mean by business rules?
So business rules are basically, in this case, several of these are business rules. For instance, processing consent, rather than being a manual step, it's basically an automatic step that will evaluate the consent, will evaluate that all the participants that have been requested have a valid consent to participate in research. So rather than sort of being, activities that are happening triggered by a human being, these are business rules that are reflected in the systems that are operationalizing these data use scenarios. So we're making some very bold assumptions here that the systems are smart enough to look up this information and make sure there are no mistakes in how the data is exchanged. And in other cases, we're making the assumption that these systems can communicate with each other and they can do that in a standardized way. And we're also making the assumption that, again, consents and authorizations are examined and processed in making a decision whether data should be returned to researchers. So yeah, that's why we explicitly call those out as business rules.
This is Ronnie Elby from the VA. If a researcher has a certificate of confidentiality, is that just built in to these processes?
Right. So if the researcher has the consent, so the researcher has the consent, and also the data site has the consent as well. So they are aware, or it's part of the data use agreement, that the consent is exists. So they would have an equivalent representation of that consent, so they know which patients. Again, they will, each data site will manage many more patients than those that are enrolled in a specific study, obviously. So it is their responsibility to distinguish which patients are enrolled in the study and which data elements should be shared. So it is a little bit more strict in the case of sensitive information than it is when there is no sensitive information involved in the case, because in this case, the authorization to disclose is given to the data site. So they are responsible to only disclose information when it's appropriate.
Thank you.
So that's what we're trying to communicate here. And I'm glad that we're having this dialogue, because if we're getting any of this wrong, that would be wrong. that would not be a very successful analysis of our requirements.
So this is Kevin. I think this is a great workflow. I mean, it really mirrors a lot of what's going on in, like, health information exchanges. But let me back up and give a real live example, because you use request data sets from covered entities, so implying one or more entities. So, imagine a patient is enrolled in a clinical trial at UNC, but they have a heart attack at Duke, right? Both of those are covered entities, so both of those organizations would need to have consent and be able to respond to one another if this individual is in some sort of study at hospital one, if you will. And then likely they have some sort of insurance coverage, which would have the, you know, maybe exposure information that was needed. So that's yet another covered entity. And I'm just trying to understand how you see overcoming some of these technical barriers to have these information management systems maintain, I would imagine, PDF documentation of thousands or hundreds of thousands of consent forms for all the various studies that would be going on.
Well, this is probably not that our charter is not to challenge whether PDF is a proper representation of a consent. I think there's another project looking into that. But all I would say in your particular example, you have one situation when information is exchanged for the purpose of research, and another situation when someone is having a heart attack when information may be retrieved for emergency.
Hold on, let me back up. My issue is, you know, the researcher retrieves research identifiers, okay, and you know, if that's, you know, study ID number one, you
right.
can't go to another covered entity with, I need data on study ID one, and they've provided consent. Like, I still am missing the technical of how this is going to be operationalized.
Right, so that is use case number four, I believe, where we're discussing how the research data identifiers are created and coordinated. Because what you're describing is a very real concern, which is, you know, I'm going to use a research identifier to request the data. You might have a mapping, perhaps, of the research identifier to a real patient ID that you'll be using to identify the records and retrieve the data accordingly. So that's actually in a different use case. It's very important. And we're making the assumption that those identities have been established, and the local and the central and the correlation between identities is operational in this particular use case. But the items that we're concerned ourselves with is to make sure that we are accounting for all these different conditions that have to be addressed by the data site before they can disclose the information. And those are the decision points that we're trying to zoom in on right now. There's more analysis done around the definition of the research identifier, both local and centralized. So the challenge you're describing is having a multi-site research identifier that is mapped to a local ID correctly every single time, right?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And obviously also with regards to consent authorization, I mean, you know, just because it was approved by one organization's IRB, that doesn't necessarily govern the privacy board at another. So I think that whole consent authorization piece is a little bit bigger than just, oh, you have IRB approval and a HIPAA waiver from somewhere.
Right.
If you don't have it from the other organization, I think this is where some of the issues around HIPAA is over here, Common Rule is over here, and there's still not an alignment between HIPAA waiver of authorization and sort of IRB approval.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And again, in some cases, you cannot have a waiver, and that was a decision, I think, that we did not include in the decision-making process. But, you know, it's not always applicable, obviously. Sorry, I think are we running a little short on time here?
Joanna, yeah.
Sure.
So
I think we're very nearly done here, though.
I think this is the last slide, and then I think we wanted to give it over to the patient choice.
Sure.
I think it's Ali and Jeremy. We're going to sort of hand it over to you, but just sort of one last comment. Kevin, you know, we will ask that, you know, you and others look at these, and if there's sort of feedback or questions or things that, you know, you see glaring gaps that we are not sort of touching on, or it's not obvious that we're touching on, you know, we'd appreciate it if you get back to us sort of outside of this. You can just send us an email, and we can, you know, set up a follow-up call with you, okay? But we are very sort of interested in refining these, and we are looking for input. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to hand it over to Jeremy and Ali, and we'll bring up the slides, and you can just cue us, okay? Ali, Jeremy, do you have audio?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Perfect, you can. Go ahead.
Yeah, hey, thanks, everyone. My name is Jeremy Maxwell. So I am with ONC, and I am heading up I'm the ONC lead for the Patient Choice technical project. So we can go ahead head to the next slide. And go ahead to the next slide. And so so this is our project team. So so I mentioned I'm the ONC lead. We have a project coordinator, is Jonathan Coleman, and we have a couple of folks from the team on the phone, some of our SMEs, as well as our project manager, Ali Khan. We can go on to the next slide. And I'm going to skip over a couple of these because I know we only have a few minutes, and I want to save time for some questions at the end. So what we're looking at with the Patient Choice Project is we have three phases that we're going through, and the overall goal of what we are trying to do is we're trying to either develop or harmonize a standard around being able to capture patient consent decisions. And so we've broken that into a couple of different phases. The first phase that we're in right now, we're focusing on what we call basic choice, following the definition of basic choice in ONC's interoperability roadmap. And that is the basic choice of, you know, someone is in or someone is out. And we're looking at a treatment payment and healthcare operation, TPO, in this first phase. And so we're specifically looking at areas where an organization's made an organizational decision to implement basic choice. We all know that the HIPAA allows for TPO to be used for patient data without a basic choice being present. But we're looking at situations where an organization has kind of gone beyond that, and for whatever reason decided to capture the patient's opt-in or opt-out for TPO purposes. We just finished up our use case development for our first phase, and we are entering into our pilot phase that will last over the summer. Starting in the fall, what we'll do is we'll kick off phase two, which we're going to be looking at basic choice for research, which will be closely aligned with some of the work that you guys are doing. In fact, the work that you guys are doing will feed into our phase two as input. And so we'll be looking at your use cases and others if needed, and we'll be looking at specifically the point at which consent is captured and the technical standards around being able to express that consent for research in a technical and standards-based way. So what we're focused on is we're focused on the standard that's used to express the consent. We're not focused on things like, what the form should look like that is presented to the patient or the research participant. We're not focused on, those human factors pieces of it. We're not focused on, how it should be worded to, make sure that, the patient or participant is giving informed consent. Those things are out of scope for our project. We're looking at once consent has been captured, being able to express it in a standards-based way so that when that consent is communicated, that the recipient can understand and semantically be able to parse that consent and be able to make access control decisions or user disclosure decisions based on that consent. So we'll start our consent for basic choice consent for research in the fall, and then that will last for about a year or so as we go through use case development and piloting, closely a lot matching the project plan that we're using for basic choice for TPO right now. And then phase three of our project will start in the following fall, where we are going to be looking at granular choice. We're breaking, instead of just saying, yes, I am all in or I'm all out, being able to break that choice down a little bit more and saying, yes, I'm in for this type of research, but I'm out for that type of research. Or yes, you may share my data with, this type of provider, but, keep my, data protected, from my payer, following the HIPAA omnibus, out-of-pocket privacy restrictions, for example. So we'll be looking at some of those more, granular use cases when we get into the third phase of our project. So I went through that in, very fast because I wanted to save some time for questions at the end. We have a couple of 10 slides in the materials that were distributed, so you can go and check out some of the details. We do have a Confluence page similar to you guys where we're keeping all of our project artifacts. And I'll stop talking there because, like I said, I did want to save some time for questions so we can answer your guys' specific questions that you have about our project.
Jimmy, thanks. I don't see anyone raising their hands. Do we have any questions on the phone?
This is Kevin with HealthCore. Real quick question. So how do I opt out of sharing PHI with my payer? That doesn't seem to make sense from a TPO standpoint. I mean, if Hospital A needs to bill insurance company, the insurance company needs to know what needs to have some information. So of course there's PHI exchange. How would the world operate if you opted out of sharing PHI with your payer who's going to pay the bill?
Yeah, I was referring to the so in the HIPAA omnibus rule, there's a right that was created for patients that are paying out of pocket for a particular encounter or service to keep that data from being shared with their health plan. So, for example, if I as a patient went to my provider because I have a cold and or the flu and they prescribed me Tamiflu. But I'm also seeing them for smoking cessation, and I pay out of pocket for the smoking cessation services. But I want my Tamiflu to, that piece of it to be billed to my health plan. That is a right as a patient that I can request that, and the provider would have to segment the data, for that granular choice, do the billing on the Tamiflu part, and let me pay out of pocket for the smoking cessation part, and the nothing about smoking cessation data could be disclosed to the health plan. So that's a right in HIPAA now, and we'll be looking at the consent standard, being able to express that technically when we get to that third phase of our granular choice.
Thanks for that clarity. I understand.
Any other questions? Jimmy, I don't see anyone else sort of raising their hands.
Okay, great. So I will mention that next week we are having a community stakeholders update call. So this is a public call that we're having on April 12th at 2:30 Eastern, where we'll be talking everything that I just gave you in 5 minutes. We'll be talking about it for an hour. So if there's additional information that you guys want to find out about our project in greater detail, you can feel free to check out the Confluence page, or you can attend our call next week, where we will be talking about it in great detail. I appreciate your time today.
Jeremy and Ali, thank you very much. We appreciate you sort of, sharing the project with this team. So I know we are sort of coming to the top of the hour. A few update items. So we have two more meetings. At the next meeting, we do have a few additional scenarios that we will be discussing with this group. And then we are going to sort of continue moving ahead with sort of additional use case analyses and to see if there's any feedback from this group. So that's one item. The other thing is you will see an email from us requesting some additional feedback on some of what we discussed today, but also on some scenarios that we presented at the last meeting related to precision medicine. So you will sort of see that from us in email. And then our next two meetings are coming up on April 20th and April 27th. Okay, so we look forward to hearing from you all on those calls as well. So I think with that, just to remind folks that we do have all of the materials posted on the Confluence website, and we've included the links, in the slide deck. So for those of you that are interested, you can certainly access all of the materials and also look at some of the more detailed content related to the patient choice presentation. I think that's all for today. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up and thank everyone for your participation today. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.